thank you so much. Yes, this is indeed part two of a two-part series, Introduction to the Spiritual Path of the PSS Nairobi. I mean, the truth is that one could have obviously many, many sessions on his legacy, but we'll begin with two. I will review a little bit what we did last week for those who are both, those who are here, those who are not here. This way it'll be helpful, hopefully, for both parties. And after a brief review, what I'd like to do is enter you into, share with you some pieces from what's shared on the screen right now, I hope is coming across to you, which is a piece from the PSS and Rabbi's B'nai Machshava Tova, an early publication of his, and then time allowing, turn to parts of one of his later works, Mevo HaShaarim. So we will get to that. Just in brief review, what we did last week is we met, as it were, the PSS and Rebbe. PSS and Rebbe, Rev Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro, lived from approximately 1889 to 1943 when he was murdered in the Holocaust. He was the scion of an illustrious Polish Hasidic aristocratic lineage line, descended from some of the greats of Polish Hasidism, has been rediscovered of as it were in North America and Israel in the last few decades, 30 years already, for a few reasons. One, because of his status as a Holocaust theologian, we might term him anachronistically. He's also known as the Warsaw Ghetto Rebbe. He wasn't officially the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, but he was a Rebbe in the Warsaw Ghetto, active during those times and leading his flock, teaching, theologizing, and leading. And we have records of those, some of his sermons. They were called, they were collected and entitled posthumously as Eish Kodesh. So he's known for that, that corpus, and for that part of his legacy. That already has been for the past 30 or maybe more years, Eish Kodesh. More recently, 10, 20, 25 years, he has been then again rediscovered or claimed as a sort of Hasidic mindfulness expert, if you will. Right, this is a person who was deeply invested, as we'll see later on, just a few minutes, in the life of the mind and in meditations and visualizations, in general inner spiritual path. For that, all of that, which, you know, we'll get to parts of that in a moment, the world has been taken by storm by mindfulness and meditation practices, elements of the neo-Hasidic world, including the Jewish renewal, but not only world, look to him as a sort of forebearer. During his life, however, he was known primarily, I would say, besides as a general Hasidic Rebbe, as an educational figure. We noted last week that he's been termed by some as Admor HaMechanech, the educational Rebbe. He had a large yeshiva in Warsaw and wrote extensively on Hasidic education. So he was a very accomplished theoretician and also practitioner. That's a general sense of who he was. We spoke last week as well about the historical milieu in which he operated, especially in interbellum, interwar Poland between World War I and World War II. He comes from the small town of, or he's active in the small town of Piaseczna, and eventually makes his way to Warsaw, as many Jews did after World War I, as they shifted from more rural to urban settings. And it's there that he founds this large yeshiva. This is a time of great turmoil and crisis, and also of creativity. Many Jews were murdered, uprooted in the course of World War I, in the aftermath of World War I, in the shift again to urban settings, economic crises, at the same time, along with ideological developments, right? So you're in Warsaw at the time when the PSS and Rebbe is writing some of his material, which we'll see later tonight. He is on the same street with leading socialist, Zionist, Bundist, Jewish intellectual figures, and that's all in terms of the Jewish population with whom he's sharing space and ideological air. So it's quite the time of creative ferment, and this is all before, of course, the Holocaust begins and the ghetto is established, and his focus becomes primarily tending to his flock, and wrestling with faith, what faith could mean in the shadows of the Warsaw Ghetto. What I wanted to do this evening, as we started this last week very, very briefly, what I wanted to do this evening is, after having given an overview and contextualization of his historical milieu, of his literary legacy, of his biography, to jump into some of his texts. There were many options to choose from. Here, I decided to start at sort of the beginning. The text in front of you, just right now on show of thumb, is the name of Shabbat Torah still shared on the screen?
It's shared.
Okay, wonderful. I just want to make sure.
Shabbat Torah.
Exactly. So this is a digitization of the text. My actual hard copy books are in my office, where we don't currently have access to very quickly. This is a text, B'nei Machshava Tova, is a pamphlet, essentially a kuntres, that he authored. It wasn't for broad publication. It was meant to be for specific readers. Part of his agenda, part of his project for the rejuvenation, and the revitalization of Hasidism, which by this point, right, we're in the 1920s, roughly, Hasidism has been around for well over 100 years, maybe it's even 170 years, right, for quite a while, and has gone through multiple generations, and there is certainly a sense among some that it has stagnated, has become stale, has become institutionalized, right, so that instead of being primarily a spiritual living force, which is affecting the inner lives of its adherents, at this point, it's for many seen as some sociological category. Right? It's a way of living. It's a modus vivendi with theological ritual trappings, but not necessarily revolutionizing the inner life of its adherents. So he comes, among as do others during this period, to try to rejuvenate, as I say. That's why some call him a neo-Chassid, actually. He's part of the neo-Chassidic revolution, sort of the likes of Kenneth, Hillel, Zeitlund. They probably would have something to talk about. Heschel, by the way, Ramesh Heschel, is also in Warsaw during the 30s, during this period. So, the Gera Rebbe, I believe, is in Warsaw. There's a lot of interesting things happening in Warsaw around this attempt to rejuvenate Hasidism. So as part of his agenda here, and here we're going to turn to the text in about just a minute, he authors this pamphlet called B'nei Machshava Tova. B'nei Machshava Tova, it's been translated to English a couple times, I believe, first as Conscious Community. It's one way of putting it. And there's another more recent translation whose title eludes me at the moment, but you could literally just see the title. B'nei indicates that it's the people who have the capacity or the competence in the following area, and they are a group, right? They're a cohort, a spiritual fraternity, if you will, a chavraya kadisha, to use the term, the Zoharic terms, which the P.S. Essener claims and wants to reinstate. It's a group which has the capacity, is dedicated to the practice of Machshava Tova. I'm trying to highlight that. I assume that comes across on your screens. The name Machshava Tova, now, people of good, or perhaps we'd say developed, Machshava. Machshava in Hebrew means thought, but as we said last week, and as I'll show you in a few minutes, it doesn't mean thought in the sense of discursive thinking, right, or cognizing, analytic thinkings or ideas. He actually means something along the form of awareness, consciousness, and at times he seems to mean machshava in the sense of the capacity to to have visualizations, right? To think images and visualizations using one's imagination. It's more the use of imagination to create visualizations and such, and to achieve a form of consciousness, less the idea of having specific types of, you know, discursive thoughts. And by Tova, he means something, he talks about this more, but he means something along the lines of, you know, a developed machshava. So what he's getting at already in the title is, his goal is to create a cohort, a fraternity of young Hasidic males who are totally dedicated to their discipline. It's kind of a monastic imagery, if you will, not because they're isolated from the world, but because of the focus and the rigor right around of a cohort around a given spiritual project. And he wants to bring them together to lead them along this spiritual path. So let's jump right in. And you'll see here, it says, you know, Tochen HaChevra. I'm scrolling down here, but this is basically the criteria for the Chevra. I'm not going to read that at length right now, but what you'll see here is, here it talks about that the Chevra has to be, it's an internally egalitarian Chevra, meaning all of the people involved, right? They're not interested in having a leader or follower. It's a group of people who are in a fraternity who are joining together around a common goal. Scroll so long. Here he has an Odalid. He has a few of the further criteria. This maybe I'll read a little bit. It's interesting. This shows you who he's talking to, what his project is about. By the way, I just remind you, of course, that you can either speak up or write into the chat box, and I hopefully will see that, and we can interact that way. As it is, I'm seeing some of your faces, but trying to, you know, be as interactive as possible. So you see here, he says, here are some of the Tanaim, right? And Reshit Kol, first of all, Amin Shichim L'moda'a Zo, Omar, we have to give the forewarning, Shirak Ela Yuchlu L'Kariv L'Khanes L'Chavra Kedisha. Only the following types of people can enter into our Chavraya Kedisha, our holy fraternity. Aleph. Only someone who truly feels a sincere pain at sensing what himself as being distant from God. We're not talking about somebody who knows, right? They sort of intellectually understand their spiritual level. Right, because that's not what he was really after. He wants someone who yargish ke'ev lev. I'm skipping as we go. Yargish ke'ev lev al shnafsho marello. He feels it. He has an emotional sensation of heartache for this feeling. And I'll just note parenthetically that this focus on hargasha, on feelings, I think I'm not going to spend much time on that tonight, but actually is a major focus of the Rebbe. May that be for another time. The Rebbe had a metaphysics of the emotions, first of all, theoretically, right? He understood the emotions to be the emotion that all of you feel, that you and I feel at various times. Enthusiasm, passion, anger, sadness, right? That these are not just sort of neural phenomena, but are refractions of the Sefirot, right? The Sefirot, the divine, the parts of the Godhead, of God's, you know, inner dynamic life, according to Kabbalistic thinking, and he's an heir to that type of thinking, you know, have this sort of dynamism, which are characterized in part by characteristics which we experience are mirrored in our emotions. So the point is that when you have an emotion, it's not just, you know, a neural thing. It's not just, you know, a phenomenon of the nerves or something like that. It actually is, that's actually part of your mirroring divinity, right? Your enthusiasm, your happiness, your joy, your maybe your anger, your sadness. These are, these partake of God actually, right? And as such, you can actually use them to connect to God because they are, right? They are implicated with God's own dynamic, God's own being, and that's really important. And he's spoken That's on the theoretical level, but on the practical level, he spoke about and taught about ways of sensitizing oneself to one's emotions, feeling one's emotions. He says somewhere, we want to make you into a feeling or emotional person. That's what we're trying to do, because being able to touch, to sense, to experience viscerally, by the way, literally, right, anyone's body, one's emotional life, one is thereby connected to God. It's not, it goes beyond the sense of chassidism as, you know, trying to get people happy and emotional because it has some sort of, you know, effect on them. It can motivate them to I don't know, whatever the desiderata one establishes, right? No, it's more, or even just for its own sake, be happy for happiness' sake, and no, it's more than that. But becoming emotional, becoming aware of one's emotions, one connects with God directly. That's a very important thing. So he says the person who joins this group, therefore, has to be someone who feels within themselves, who feels, right? Actually feels the heartache of being distance from God. He has to be Bet Ben Torah, Ima'atim Harbe. So this is not somebody who is external from the world of the traditional observance and learning. It's somebody who actually builds upon that. He has to be somebody who who's actually somebody who is a worker or something like that. He has a business, that's fine. But if Ned, that's more kol panim shalosh panim b'shavu l'makom chavra. But he has to still show up 3 times a week to the meeting place and dedicate himself to those times, etc. But shalosh yehesh shakran, he can't be a liar. He has to be straightforward and honest. You want someone who's totally true. Inkin Aish, right? Someone who's inherently a liar, who's so deeply invested in, who's so deeply habituated in some form of deceit. He'll lie, Miramet Acherim, he'll cheat or lie to others, and also he will lie to himself. Right? So he wants people a certain character type. What does he want them to do? As follows. So we started this last week, let's come back to it now. I'm now reading the goals of the chevra. Otalaf. Hapasuk miaseret Yisrael va'omer. The verse says, and this is what we did last week, v'tashkach el mechol aleka. The verse in Deuteronomy speaks of the tragedy of people forgetting God. V'tashkach el, they forgot God. So he says, zehu ikar hasiba shemarcheket et adam min Elohav. This forgetfulness, forgetting, this is also very important, the forgettingness, is the primary reason, the primary sin, if you will, that causes people to distance themselves from God. Right? And the opposite of that forgetfulness, and here again, he does not mean forgetting a piece of data. He means something about their consciousness, right? They are not, their thoughts, their inner life is distant from God. So he says, the opposite of that would be somebody who has machshava, what he calls tova in short. He's quoting from Elimelech of Lizhensk, his forebearer, actually, his ancestor, that the machshava should be pure and clear and strong. What does it mean to have clear and strong machshavot? It doesn't mean that you have strong analytic skills. Right? He means somebody who has strong consciousness, somebody who has strong use, has trained themselves in the use of the imagination in visualization, so they're in control of their machshavot and can utilize them to experience essentially divinity or experience the divine through various means. Right? Everyone knows that if they would mamash see themselves standing before God, they would have no yetzer hara. The problem is we don't see ourselves that way. We don't see the world that way. And he claims that the world that we actually see, the physical world, is not an illusion, as some, you know, mystics might claim, right? That here I'm holding a cup like I had last week, right? So they might claim that this cup is an illusion, and actually it's actually, you know, just divinity or something along those lines. It's matter, but imbued by a platonic form. No, he thinks actually that the physical world does really exist, but in its existence in the as material, it It is an extension of an expression of divinity, right? So this is a cup, and this cup, in this cup somehow is God. Leta tar panur mine, as they say in Kabbalah. There's no place, there's nothing which is absent, from which God is absent. So someone who actually can see with their very eyes, can learn to see the physical world and physical reality, and can experience himself standing in front of God in that moment, partly through the use of his machshavot, so that's somebody who would have no yetzer hara, and that is somebody who would have remedied this crisis of forgetfulness, of forgetting God. Here we'll continue to Ot Bet, but I'll skip Ot Bet, which we did not get to last week, so we only started. So here we go. So the improvement and strengthening of the machshava. Zehu yusod chavrotenu. That is our primary goal. Our b'nei machshava tova. I'm creating a spiritual cohort of Hasidic elites who will have chizuk machshava. This is our primary means of attaching ourselves to divine service. We'll be able to attach ourselves to divine service this way, not like some sort of lowly servant who behind the mill sees God, rather from a distance, right, is aware of God, but it's not close, it's not intimate. Now he wants a life, kiven shemargish et kivutav shel aviv. He wants to have a relationship where it's much more intimate, it's familial. It's like a son who feels, again, that term, that ruta hargashal hargish shemargish kivutav shel aviv, who actually feels. And these are not just like rhetorical flourishes. He actually speaks to the core of his mission here, of his project, people who can feel the closeness of one's father, God. So if indeed, let's assume that all of us on this call right now have been so quickly convinced that the key towards spiritual practice is chizuk machshavas, becoming b'nei machshavah tova, that by training our consciousness and our imaginative faculties, by meditating and visualizing specific things, we'll be able to come close to God, to progress on our spiritual path, to become, in another language, enlightened beings of sorts. So assuming we become convinced of that, the question is, so what's so hard about that? What actually is so difficult about achieving that? So he identifies, if he assesses and does, two primary obstacles. This is worth paying attention to. He says as follows. One and two, right? Aleph and Bet. So he says, one. Here's the first obstacle. He'ader hitorerut bein hitlahavu shel simcha uvein shel shvirat halev. He says, first of all, we have a lack of, I'd say, awareness or awakeness. Or maybe arousal, we could say, it's overroot, it's overroos. Whether it's during those moments of hislavos, of hitlahavut, whether it's the moments of passion, of joyous passion, or when it's those moments of shvirat halev, of brokenheartedness. And I think all of us on this call probably have those moments, right? Moments, I hope people have at least the moments of, just tremendous joy. And also, it's part of the human condition that people experience moments of breaking of the heart. So he says, people are often simply unaware and unmoved, right? Unaroused, unawakened. They're sleeping through these experiences. Again, experiencing these emotions is so key to him. Because every moment that the Israelite, he calls sometimes the Jew, the Israelites, one of my senior colleagues suggested he calls them Israelites because it sort of harkens, it has a sort of archaic feel to it, rather than calling them a Yehudi or a Yid or something like that in Yiddish, right? He speaks of the Israelites, right? Back to the biblical legacy, he speaks, and I'll come to that in a moment. Ish Yisrael mitaher mitlahev, b'afilu, that when the Jew, when the Israelite is mitaher, it becomes, it's by its nature to become excited, passionate, to have enthusiasm. Our emotions are triggered. V'afil b'ma'atit orerut kvar, excuse me, machshavato yoter chazaka. Yoter chazaka hi. Tehora le'ela mitzirei gufo v'dimyonohi. And even with a little bit of hit orerut, a little bit of this enthusiasm or arousal, awakeness, that itself already lends itself to stronger machshava, to pure machshava during those times, right? So our emotional state has to be cultivated if we're to achieve, become b'nei machshava Torah, Tova, right? Like we say, like in Yom Kippur, he says people who, during those moments in Yom Kippur, Ne'ila or something, whatever moment, when there's this emotional activation, so then he says it's not, then people can imagine themselves, see themselves standing in right, literally in front of God, living in the, in with God consciousness, living in God's presence. Right? But you need that emotional activation to achieve that. Right? The problem is that our hearts and minds, libo mocho matum tamim, right? They're closed up, they're foolish. And we don't actually have the ability because to have machshava in those moments, which isn't material. So we can only think of things with our, even with our minds, even with our imagination, which are material and banal and pedestrian and, you know, of olam hazan, and we can't, let loose and let our imaginations become unfettered and soar above. And that's true, even during times of apparent joy, it's all the more so when you have atzvut, right, when one is depressed. Right? Actually, I forget who said this to me, but someone noted that, he pays attention to emotions, and he says that, atzvut, is different than Shirat HaLev, as he mentioned earlier. Atzvut, he's planning something along the lines of sadness, or maybe we'd call it depression today, not necessarily clinical depression, but some form of depressive state. And that is kind of, for him, like a non-emotion. That's just sort of the state of being flat and dulled, of a limp emotional state, right, without any strength to itself. That's different than Shirat HaLev, a brokenheartedness. You can read a sad novel, hear a beautiful piece of sad music, and you're led to tears. That you certainly couldn't be said in that moment to be not feeling. You're actually feeling very deeply. You're feeling sadness. You're feeling Shirat HaLev, right? So that's actually a positive in certain respects. Atzvut, depression, which is the lack of feeling, is a flatness, would not be a negative. So he's basically claiming, and I'll move on to the next OT here. He's basically claiming that so far that one of the primary obstacles to achieving achieving the goals of the spiritual path is that we don't have emotional arousal, emotional awakeness, right? We're sleeping through that part of our lives. I don't know if this resonates with people on the call, but certainly for myself, that definitely does resonate. It's something to be said for this claim that inside of us is our tremendous mountains and peaks and valleys and dips, and planes of emotional experience that we just don't pay much attention to, right? We sort of live past it. It's somewhere in us, but we're not, our consciousness is elsewhere. To him, that's a great tragedy. And by not paying attention to that emotional landscape, we are cutting ourselves off we're sleeping through life, essentially. We're forgetting. That's why we are forgetting. Second of all, that v'od chisaron yishbo, there's a second, lacking in us. Hu mum tivi she'en lo b'chlal machshava chazaka, and this is natural, which is that we simply don't have strong machshavot. We have not developed and cultivated, we've not exercised that the muscle of the imagination. Right? This is like we say, leval seichel katan. For example, if you tell somebody who is of limited mental capacity, let's say you tell them something new. You tell them some new chadash davar chachma, right? For some sort of advanced piece of information, some new, whatever, you know, mathematical chidush or something, or whatever it is. Sometimes when he doesn't have the intellectual capacity to understand, right? He, his sichlo katan, he won't understand. And because of this limitation, lo dai shagam b'shat hit over root, he says so too, right? Just like somebody who, you know, who has limited mental capacity, so somebody who hasn't, who has limited imaginative capacity, they've never thought of this. So never, no one's ever taught them to work on their imagination. Right? Who ever thought of that as like the goal of the spiritual practice, right? But he says, and that's our primary goal, or at least that probably means of spiritual practice, is to develop your ability to imagine and visualize. So if you don't do that, lo dai, which is totally natural, like in other words, not having that capacity is natural. Lo dai shekam b'shati t'orerut, af shemachshavato mitoreret, umitchazeket, eina chazeka kamosh shichal iyot. Then what's going to happen is, not only is it that during times of hit'orerut, when he is awakened, it won't be as strong as it should be, ela shekom machshavato hu rak b'shat hit'orerut levad, v'achar kach shuv nader b'menu. But rather, what's going to happen is he's only going to have strong machshava, a strong capacity to live in God's presence, to have the consciousness to see God, to be in God's presence. He'll only have that during the times that he is emotionally awakened. And any other time, that's it. Right? He's left to his total pedestrian life. And this comes to a key line here. So here's a moment to refocus. Klomar. Aish bala machshava chazaka. Right, in the positive, someone who is a bal machshava chazaka, someone who has developed a capacity for machshava, who is b'nei machshava tova, who is a ben machshava tova, I should say, az b'sha'ah shemitorer u'mitlahev, then during times that he's achieved the emotional states of arousal, awakenedness, fiery enthusiasm, lashon lahav, machshavato mitchazeket, then his machshava becomes stronger. Uvara is clear. The ro'eh b'machshavato v'dimyono dimyon shel Yisrael b'nei nevi'im. This is a huge line. Then at that time, he will see with his imagination, with his thought and imagination, an imagery of Yisrael b'nei nevi'im, the prophetic. He will achieve prophecy of some sort. He will see at Hashem Yisbarach v'kisei kivodo. He will behold God. Amazing. The imagination can, when cultivated properly, when strengthened by emotional activation, by fiery enthusiasm, by passion, can yield prophecy of a sort. And this claim is really central, I think, to the PSS. The Pesach is trying to create Hasidic prophets. That's why I asked Rabbi Kalman to call the series Hasidic prophets, because he's trying to create nothing less than Nevi'im during our times. Now, what does he mean by Nevi'im here? So that's an interesting question. What does he mean by prophets? Does he mean people who can, in Warsaw 1930, tell you what's going to happen in whatever Toronto in 2020? No, not necessarily. He doesn't necessarily even mean people who can give political advice or general, whose job it is to give general, you know, moralistic, you know, chastisements to the people like the Nevi'im did in the Tanakh. They may do those things. That's not entirely clear. At least in terms of the latter activity. The former, I think he says, we don't have that capacity anymore. But what he means is, prophecy in the sense of the ability to see, like I said before, to collapse the distinction between the material and the spiritual. To collapse the distinction between the physical, the material, and the spiritual. To see in the material and hearing therein divinity. That is what I think he means by creating Nevi'im in the fundamental sense. As a derivative thereof, perhaps, as a derivative of that, he would say perhaps that they have these other capacities at least in the days of old, of telling the future and things like that. But fundamentally, it is an ability to experience God's presence quite literally. So what he wants to do, therefore, is to, and because of these are the two things which obstacles which block somebody from experiencing Machshavah Tovah, he of course wants to remedy them, right? And to cultivate Hitlahavut, to cultivate Hitoverut, to cultivate Hitzazer Hitrakshut, emotionality, to systematically and deliberately strengthen people's Machshavah, their meditation, meditative capacities, their visualization capacities, their imaginative faculty. And this is his project for this group. Now, this is an enormously ambitious project, right? Creating this cohort and requires tremendous, resources of energy. He goes on in other texts to talk about, or other moments in the text, in other texts to talk about the economic factors that go into this. It's to say you have to be able to sustain a group of spiritual elites. Here, I guess he talks about people who are ba'alei, who are workers, and they have the professionals, but they are dedicated to this as well. He talks in other places of the need to really have communal funds dedicated to supporting these Hasidic elites if we're ever going to have a real rejuvenation of Hasidism. So if you're familiar with the institutions of Kest, of Essentag, he says that we need to reinstate the practice of basically feeding yeshiva students or kollel students, right? These Hasidic avreichim, so that they can be fully dedicated to their practice. Their practice has become undervalued, so that people no longer want to support, their son-in-law or some member of the community to pursue these things. But he thinks that that's actually critical. They need that space to practice and to cultivate if they're ever going to act as this fiery nucleus, this warm nucleus, from which will emerge a spark and a rejuvenation of Hasidism at large. Okay, I think this is a good time, given our talking about prophecy. He goes on here, of course, at length, but I want to see if I can share with you a piece of different text for the final few minutes of our time together tonight, and that is from Mevor Sha'arim. So let me see if I can stop share and then restart. Give me one moment. I'm going to try to share. Here we go. Okay. Did that work, Rick Hellman? Is there a new document? Great. Okay.
That works.
Wonderful. Okay. Just making sure. Thank you. So this is from a text called Mevor Sha'arim. This is the third of his educational works. But I wanted to talk about prophets. I wanted to spend a couple of minutes with this text. This is a text that I worked on heavily over the past few years. It's called Mevor Sha'arim, as I say, which could be translated as, something along the lines of like the introduction, right? The entrance, but literally means the entrance to the gates. And I'd like to think that he means something about that. He's indicating this is an entrance into the gates of Hasidism. So he says here as follows, I'll start from here. He says, this is the book, he actually calls it interestingly, this is the book Chovat Avrichim, Sefer Chovat Avrichim. This is the book which is about the obligations of the advanced chassid, the avreich. His first book, which is called Chovat HaTalmidim, which is more well known, was geared for younger students. This is meant to be the opening of the third book, and he begins it with an introduction called Entrance to the Gates. Right, and this is the third, he says here, of the series of Chovat HaTalmidim and Hashemot Avreichim, two other works I mentioned last week, and only one who's read those may read this book. Right, so I know you guys haven't necessarily done that, but you see that he clearly sees this as a series, a trilogy that you're meant to work through, go from one to the second to the third, and you get to Mevor Sha'arim. It's signed by Kolonimus Kalmish, the diminutive of Kalman, son of the holy rabbi, Rev Eli Melech of Grzinsk. That was his father who passed away when he was quite young. Av Beis Din, Av Beis Din of Piasechna. right? The head of the Beit Din HaPSS. Now, in the manuscript, I believe, you see that those words, Av Beit Din, were crossed out, right? Probably when he was editing the work, when he was already in Warsaw, and PSS No, I guess, was destroyed or had been, and everyone had left already. Okay, so he says as follows. I'm just going to read some citations, or some selections here. Again, please feel free to comment in the chat. I don't see any chats yet, or ask any questions. But I give you some of the highlights at the beginning here. So he says, you know what? We learned in the Talmud and Megillah. I'll read you my translation. Tanur Rabbanan, the rabbis taught that there were 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses who prophesied to Israel, and none of them added or detracted from the Torah, right? Except for Mikra Megillah, it's a separate point. But basically, they didn't add or detract from the Torah. The truth is, there are many more prophets, right? But they only the prophecies which are necessary for all generations were included and canonized in the Tanakh. The rest were lost to history. So he asks a basic question, which is, you know, what is the point of these prophets if they're not going to add or detract from Torah? If they're not going to leave some sort of fun, it's not going to do comment on or fundamentally alter the corpus of Torah, why did you really need them? He says. What do we really need them for? So Rashi talks about they're needed to teach repentance or other things. They need to give hora'ah. Again, but he said, what does hora'ah actually mean, though? I mean, they're not adding to the Torah. They're not detracting from the Torah. Are they just giving halacha psakim? That's what any chacham can do, right? What are they really doing here? So he says, and I wanna share the following lines. This is quite a discursive text. It goes on for quite a while, but I want to just give you a highlight. He says as follows. Pardon me, let's scroll down. He says, look, it's true that, to our distress, we have neither prophet nor seer nowadays, right? We have no more real prophecy in the sense of telling the future anymore. Here he's borrowing this from the, he's learning this or deriving this from the Gemara and Sota. He says, and therefore we know only a little bit of what these prophets really were. But here's a key line. I think we're going to probably end with this line or this passage or in a few passages. But of the essence of the prophet and his Holy Spirit, Ruach HaKodesh, right? We know nothing. We don't know anything about them. And therefore, because we don't really know about the essence of the prophet, we make the following mistake. We perceive him, the prophet, only in accordance with our needs. That is to say, as somebody who tells the future, a portender, right, or someone who advises militarily, like the prophets did, you know, in Tanakh, but you know, Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Hosea. He says, but the thing is that even in yesteryear, during the times of the prophets, people saw them as pillars of fire. That's to say, they understood them to be, let me find you now, scroll down again to the real line. Yeah, here we go. He says, here's the thing I need to teach you, he says to the reader, and that which we've lost sight of. The term prophet does not describe the essence of the prophet, but merely that God has spoken with him, right? Navi milashon articulation, right, to speak. So they're called prophets because they tell the future. That's true. But more fundamentally, right, they are something else entirely. Fundamentally, the prophet is somebody who is a certain type of person, right? He's someone who has an essence, but their essence is someone who's achieved, here we go, an ungraspable spiritual essence of which we perceive only as actions. So the point he's making here, and I'll illustrate it in a moment with an analogy, is that, you know, we mistake the prophets for the prophet's activities, right? We think that since a prophet told the future, portends and such, that's what defines the prophet. Right? So that's a big mistake, right? There's a difference between what something is inherently and what they do. For example, he says, his grandfather, the Maggid of Kuznets, I'm highlighting again page 137 in my translation, Please move this window away from the sharing. He says, regarding my father, Magid of Kuznets, may the memory of the righteous be a blessing. He says, you know, the essence of who the Magid of Kuznets was is impossible to describe with words. Everybody knows that he, you know, knew much Torah and that he was a righteous person, etc. That's true. But the essence of who he was not somebody who knew a lot of Torah, was not somebody who was righteous. Those are things about him, right? But he himself was a certain type of person, which he doesn't really articulate what that person was. He thinks you couldn't actually articulate that. The point is, therefore, that, and here I quote, when we speak of the prophet and prophecy, we speak of a type of greatness in hearing the essence of the worshiper, of the obeyed, yet indescribable, attainable only upon performing the avoda of prophecy. I think I'll end with this line. Says the PSS there. Nivuah, is a form of avoda, and he's not the first one to say this, but it's important to articulate this tonight. Prophecy is a form of, it's a spiritual practice, and it's a spiritual, it's a rung on the spiritual ladder. Chassidic parlance, avoda is a form of, you know, spiritual practice of worship. So there's an avoda. There's a type of spiritual practice of what we call of the prophetic type, which doesn't mean telling the future. And that could be a derivative of that activity, but it's about becoming a type of person. It's about becoming a person of a certain spiritual stature. And therefore, what he's trying to create in his B'nai Machshava Tova is a group of people, a cohort, which has achieved that status. Right? Who practice the avoda of prophecy. Not that they tell the future, but they are heirs to the spiritual practice of the Nevi'im. And so Chassidism at its core, he thinks, is heir to the prophetic line as transmitted through Chazal and the Kabbalists, developed through each group in each epoch, and ultimately culminating in Chassidism. And again, this type of avoda is an avoda which is very much dependent upon development and cultivation of emotions, experience of emotions, and visualizations, imaginations of developing a machshava tova, a strong imaginative faculty, becoming strong of consciousness. So I hope that you can have seen already or appreciate already with this very brief overview of parts of his teachings, why he might have attracted so much attention over these years lately, and why I think he held much power over contemporary practitioners and readers alike. If you have a person speaking in the 1920s, 1930s, in the midst of interbellum Poland, who speaks of the need to cultivate emotional intelligence, through emotional awareness, of the need to focus not only on external practices and behaviors and norms, which he was absolutely a normative, a normative orthodox figure. But we have a person who shifts the focus, or maybe highlights how Hasidism shifts the focus inwards, and dedicates itself to the cultivation of the inner life, of the life of the imagination, a life of visualization, a life of spiritual practices, meditation, of song, of enthusiasm and of passion, and these things are part of the path of the which lead one to the practice, the rungs of the prophets. Let me pause for a moment. I'm seeing some chats come in. What do we have here? So Chaim Besson writes, did he succeed in creating this group? Did they produce any famous works or rebellion? I think he had some Talmidim, but I don't know if we know if he, you know, how active this group actually was. And no, I don't know that they produced any various works or rebellion. I mean, remember that the whole project was interrupted by the Shoah, right? So as he's actually editing the work that we just read, he is living in the Warsaw Ghetto and has his family killed, his students killed, right? I forget, yeah, I mean, this total decimation, say the least, of his world. So maybe now, some students did survive, but I don't think very many. And Red Kelman asks, how does he compare to Rabbi Shaul Salanter? So there are those who thought, you know, I think especially Dan Reiser, Rabbi Kelman, if you're interested, Dan Reiser has written about a chapter in one of his books is about visualization techniques in the Musar movement. I think in terms of the focus on Musar, on the need to have, strong ethical traits, but also to train oneself in midot more generally. So he talks about that as well in the beginnings of his works. But, you know, I'm not an expert in Rousseau Salanter. I will say that that Pius Nestor is explicit that, you know, those first steps of first, you know, removing, imagine like the one spiritual life as a room. So first removing, you know, debris and cleaning up the room and then actually beautifying the inner room. These are all necessary prerequisites, preludes to progressing on the spiritual path, but they're not the end of it. So I don't know what Rousseau Salanter might say about that, but a Pius Nestor certainly takes it further. Okay, so we've done these two brief sessions with you all. Is again, and then I'll close. We introduced you to the world, the milieu of the Pius Nestor, in terms of Hasidism, in terms of interbellum Poland. Introduced you to his literary legacy and to his spiritual, incredibly ambitious project. And tonight, I hope that you have appreciated joining me as we delved into just some of his texts, one from the 1920s and one from some point during the 1930s. I don't think we know exactly when he composed all these works. I hope you can sense his spiritual passion and some of the features of his legacy that have attracted such attention. Okay, so
thank you.